Start? Okay. Hi guys, I'm Saad, as some of you may know, or most of you. And today, along with my fellow presentation partners, Emily and Jacob, I'll try and convince you about the reasons for why bicycles are stable. Well, actually, bicycles are quite common around us all over Waterloo. I often wonder when will I eventually get hit by one along Laurel Trail, but it hasn't happened yet. So one must wonder why that is the case. Hopefully I'll be able to convince you that it's actually safer to be around bikes than you may think. So, as a brief outline for today, I'll be talking about basically what is the main factor behind the stability of bicycles. That's the centrifugal force. Well, since we'll be considering the non-inertial reference frame, just in case. And also a disclaimer, all units are SI units, so there are no pounds, inches, whatever. And then later on, Jacob will talk about certain proposed mechanisms which give rise to this force, aka the steering effect, the gyroscopic stabilization, and Emily will finish off with the effects of the normal torque and give the concluding remarks. So, as a simple sort of plan diagram, I've got a guy who's almost about to fall over, something that happened to me. I actually did fall over yesterday while practicing. So, the idea basically is that while you're leaning like this, you're obviously unstable because the force, your weight is pushing you down. However, the cyclist can correct it by steering along in the direction of the lean. And as he does so, he introduces essentially a circular path for his wheel, which results in a centrifugal force, which pushes him back outwards. And that is essentially the main reason for the stability of bikes. Emily and Jacob will actually talk about it in more detail, how this force arises. Now, to give you a brief description of what the basic numbers really are like for this situation, we have the angle of lean, as I discussed before. We have the wheelbase, which is the distance between the centers of the two wheels, and the caster angle, which is the angle that these, basically your handlebars, the axis of the handlebars, makes with the road. And the angle of steer is how much you're turning your steering. Using these quantities, in fact, we can calculate the turning radius for the bike. So how, obviously, the sharper your steering angle is, the shorter your turning radius would be, as is demonstrated in the formula over here. And that's a standard textbook formula. The derivation's not that hard. You can look it up if you want. Cool. So we'll use this, in fact, to come up with a few numbers. Basically, in terms of the centrifugal force, that's the standard eighth grade formula, mv squared over r. And it's going this way, horizontally along the x-axis, whichever convention you're using. And we'll be looking at the weight force, and that's actually its component that is causing you to fall over. And what we will consider is the equilibrium situation when the two equate to each other. So let me just demonstrate that here. Using the standard numbers for a cyclist with a bicycle, roughly 80 kilograms, something like that. And we've left theta as an open parameter because we'll be considering the effect of different thetas and phi being the steering angle later on. So using a cyclist with a cycle with roughly 80 kilograms, we'll have force of 800 newtons. I'm taking G to be 10, roughly. And a bike, most bikes actually, optimally have 45% of the weight through the rear wheel. So we'll consider that. And standard trig gives you these expressions. We can equate those to obtain the equilibrium condition, which allows us to eventually, blah blah math stuff, to arrive at a steering angle, expression for the steering angle, which I'll actually demonstrate to you what the effects are via a graph made on Excel, I think. Yes. OK. So here we have the angle of lean, there we have the steering angle, and what is actually quite obvious from here is that the low gradient of the graphs indicates actually that even for very, very high degrees of lean, about 18 degrees, you'll only have to steer very little. So I was probably leaning over quite a lot that I fell over. Another important thing to actually look at is the speed. So with the speeds, the gradient is going down. And so obviously when you're faster, you're less likely to fall over. Probably counter to what some people might have thought before. But that actually sort of makes sense. If you just push a bicycle very fast and let it go, it keeps going. If it was going slowly, it would tend to fall over, in fact. So that finishes what I'll be talking about. And Jacob will take over from here. Over to you.
So one idea of where this stuff is coming from is if I'm riding a bicycle, I can maybe correct for a microphone.
Okay. Let me see. Does this thing hook on or do you just hold it? Okay. Okay, it's complicated. So one idea is that if you're riding a bicycle, you can steer just enough so that you can provide a sufficient force so that you can correct for this lean. So if we look at this picture of Albert Einstein, we can see that he's slightly turning his wheel and he's slightly leaning over. So maybe this is a reasonable explanation. However, a bicycle is still quite stable, even if there is no rider on it, you can still sort of make it go. So when I was younger, I used to maybe jump off of a bicycle and see how far I can make it go. yes, so this guy named David Jones, who presented a paper on the subject, he did it a little more carefully, and he was able to get it to be stable for about 20 seconds, whereas a normal bicycle will fall over within 2 seconds, and by normal, I mean stationary. So what is one effect of explaining the no rider problem? So there's no rider and yet it's still stable. So one idea is that the wheels are acting like gyroscopes and that produces a torque and that will keep the bicycle from falling over. So we can actually calculate some numbers. We can have a torque which is equal to the moment of inertia times the velocity of precession and the velocity of the wheel spinning, and the velocity of precession is a standard formula. You can find it in the literature. You can just take it to be the change in the angle over time, which ends up being given as this. And so you can calculate the work required, and it ends up being for an angle of about 10 degrees, you get about 2 joules per wheel. So the question is now, are we going to go over 2 joules a wheel or under 2 joules a wheel? So yes, this picture is just designed to be indicating a rider with a lot of mass. So yes, so if we are staying under 2 joules a wheel, then the bicycle will automatically correct itself and it will push itself back up. But if there is more 2 joules of a wheel, then the bicycle will fall over. So if you have a gravitational potential energy, just given by the standard formula, and m is the mass, and h is the center of mass height. And so here is a graph of how you can actually calculate the center of mass height. You basically assume your body is here, maybe 1.7 meters up, and you can have a frame and a wheel and another wheel, and you can calculate the center of mass from that, and it ends up being about 0.85 meters. You can calculate some numbers, and this energy will end up being about 10 joules for 10 degrees. So the gyroscopic effect is overcome by your gravitational weight and you will fall over the bicycle. Now, actually, if you assume that there is no rider, then the mass is reduced by a factor of 6 and the center of mass will also decrease because you no longer have a body there. Everything is lower, mass is lower. So the energy will reduce by at least a factor of 6 and that will give you less than 2 joules a wheel and the bicycle will be stable if there's no rider. So here is a picture, which is also made in Excel. And this is a plot of, for different angles, what's going on with the gyroscope, and for different angles, what your gravitational potential energy is. And as you can see, the gravitational energy is greater than the gyroscopic energy, so the bicycle will fall over if there is a rider. But if there's not a rider, then it will remain stable. So David Jones, the person who wrote the paper on this, he made what he called an unrideable bicycle, where basically he wanted to see if he could get a bicycle to not be rideable. And so what he did, he tried to cancel out this gyroscopic effect, so he added an extra wheel in here to add a gyroscopic effect or a torque in the opposite direction, and this torque cancels the original torque, and he still ended up being able to ride it. So the gyroscope on its own is not able to explain why the bicycle is still stable. However, where he just rolled it without a rider on it, it fell over almost immediately. So the gyroscope is sufficient for explaining when there's no mass on it. So perhaps if there is a rider on it, then the rider will steer. But it is possible to ride a bicycle without any handlebars. So usually the reason why people don't ride bicycles without the handlebars is because they themselves don't have the balance to stay on the bicycle. But if you assume that the person has, yes?
Nothing.
Oh. But if you assume that the person has sufficient balance, then you can still ride the bicycle without any handlebars, as I am demonstrating here. So now I'm going to give it to Emily to explain where the force will be coming from if there's a rider on it. I'm going to try to give you this thing. I don't know.
All right then, so where are we at? We have this question of how is it that a bicycle is still relatively stable even if there's a heavy load on it, given that we know that under those circumstances the gyroscopic effect is not adequate to explain the stability. And so if there's a heavy load, either not a person or a person who's not steering, what is it that's responsible for the stability in that case? Fortunately, there is another mechanism which comes into play in this situation, and that depends on quite a subtle feature of bicycle frame design, which is that the point of contact where the front wheel touches the ground is typically offset from the point where the steering axis, that's the line going through the handlebars to the front wheel, it's offset from the point where that makes contact with the ground. The distance between those two points depends on the bicycle frame construction, obviously, but we're typically talking about 50 millimeter distance. So, as you all know, of course, there's going to be a weight force acting through the front wheel at the point of contact. And if the bicycle is upright, that weight force will go straight up. But if the bicycle's leaning, we're going to get a component of that force which acts to the left. And since that force is acting through the point of contact rather than through the steering axis, it produces a torque about the steering axis. And that torque is, of course, approximately the trail distance multiplied by the component of the force that we're talking about. So using the same standard values we've been using throughout the presentation, 83 kilograms, now using about 55% of that mass going through the front wheel, we calculate that the torque in a standard case is going to be about 22 sine theta, where theta is that angle of lean. So what's the effect of that torque? Now, the torque acts on the front wheel and causes it to turn, and fortunately, it causes it to turn into the direction of the lean. So if you recall, what Saad told you right at the beginning was if you turn into the direction of the lean, that causes your bike to travel in a circular path. The circular path produces a centrifugal force that pushes the bike back upright. So what that means is that miraculously, completely in the absence of any intervention from the rider, your bicycle just knows, basically, to steer in the direction which causes it to stabilise, to go back upright. So that means that even if the rider does nothing at all, doesn't intervene in any way, the bicycle will nonetheless steer in the right way to keep itself upright. As a rider, you can interfere with that effect. You can move yourself around, for instance, and shift your weight in order to change the normal force, in order to control the way in which these torques take effect. But the important point is that this effect will still work no matter whether the bicycle rider tries to intervene or not. I think it's also quite interesting to note that sort of by trial and error, people who design bicycle frames realise the importance of having this offset between these points, of having the trail distance without actually being aware of the function of that offset, because this effect was only sort of quite recently noted by the physicist David Jones. So it's interesting to see how that has come into bicycle frame construction without sort of awareness of the reasons behind that. So there's one thing you might be worried about, which is what, given that there are these torques acting on the bicycle wheel to push it outwards, away from the direction of motion, you might think that as soon as there's even any very small lean to one side, and those torques will come into effect, push the wheel out of the direction of motion, and that's going to make it impossible to ride your bike in a straight line. You know, if there are all these torques constantly trying to make you veer off your direction of motion, how is it that it's not really all that hard to travel in a straight line? How is it in particular that a riderless bicycle will still tend to travel in a straight line, even though there's no one to sort of hold it in the direction of motion? So there are a couple of proposals you might make. And the first and most obvious one is that there might be an opposing torque from friction which comes into effect when the bicycle wheel turns out of the direction of motion. So let's just have a look at that possibility. Obviously, the frictional torque if you're facing straight ahead, will just be straight backwards. However, if you turn your wheel out of the direction of motion in the way that we've just been discussing, there'll be a component of that multiplied by sine phi, where phi is that angle of turn, and that is once again, because it's acting through the point of contact rather than through the steering axis point, that's going to produce a similar torque about the steering axis. But that torque is now to the right rather than left, that is, it's in opposition to the normal torque. So yes, we get what we want, we get that as soon as the wheel turns out, we get a frictional torque pushing it back into the direction of motion. But now let's put in some numbers to see if that effect is actually going to be adequate to do what we want. So we've assumed some typical sort of values for the coefficient of rolling friction. So, you know, under normal sorts of pressures, on a normal sort of road, we get a coefficient of rolling friction of about 0.02. And so we calculate a frictional force of about 7 newtons through that wheel. So that produces a torque of about 0.4 sine phi. And so we can see if we want those torques to be equal, we have to equate those. But as you can see from that expression, typically for if those angles are of similar orders, the torque from friction is going to be significantly less than the torque from the normal. And indeed, if you have a look at that equation, you'll find that there's actually no angle phi whatsoever which can solve that equation if theta is anything more than about 1.5 degrees. So for anything more than a very small angle of lean, there's just no steering angle which will ever produce frictional torques that will compensate. And so your bike wheel would be expected to turn all the way out. So the frictional torque cannot, in fact, be the explanation that we're looking for. The real explanation, then, is that we have our bike wheels acting somewhat like the caster wheels on a supermarket trolley. So that is, we have the two wheels converging into a single path. So we have our front wheel travelling along on a certain plane, the back wheel and the rest of the bike travels along behind it in the same plane. And so if the front wheel tries to turn out of that plane, the inertia of the rest of the bike will cause it to turn back into the plane and keep you moving more or less in a straight line. So what that means is that the front wheel is able to turn through small angles, enough to the small angles that we discussed that produce the centrifugal effect that keeps it upright, but it won't continue turning all the way out. It will turn back into the direction of motion, and that means that you are, as a bicycle rider, are normally able to travel in a straight line. It means that a riderless bicycle will move along more or less in a straight line, despite the absence of anyone doing anything to keep it on track. In summary, then, what we've seen is that you have to treat the action of this bicycle in two quite separate regimes. So we have the regime where the load is quite small, so there's no rider and nothing on the bike. Under those circumstances, the weight force is small. The normal force is also going to be small, and that means the normal torque effects I've discussed are pretty negligible. Under those circumstances, then, what's important is the gyroscopic effect that Jacob discussed. The gyroscopic forces are sufficient to overcome the relatively small changes in potential energy you get from lowering the centre of mass, and so it's the gyroscopic effect that keeps that bike upright. And that explains why David Jones's bike fell over when it was pushed without a rider, because he'd cancelled out the gyroscopic effects. There was nothing else, nothing very much else there to keep the bicycle upright. On the other hand, you have the regime where there's a heavy load. So either there's a bicycle or you strap something to the bicycle or something on top to weigh it down. Under those circumstances, you get large changes in potential energy from lowering the center of mass, and those changes in energy are going to cancel out the energy encompassed in that gyroscopic effect. So the gyroscope doesn't provide the explanation in that case. What does provide the explanation is the normal torque that I've discussed. So the normal torque comes into effect, causes you to travel in the slightly circular path that provides the centrifugal force to keep you upright. And so that explains why it is that even someone very uncoordinated like me can normally stay more or less upright on top of their bicycle, why we are able to continue riding with sort of minimum of disaster. So that we've just got a list of some references here which show you where we got our formula and our standard figures from, but that's more or less it from us. Are there any questions?
Unicycle, you would probably have to do it mainly by step. So that's one reason that a unicycle, I haven't actually tested this out, I don't know, but I would imagine that a unicycle does not have that sort of extra stability that it's stable by itself in the same sort of way. You have to provide the intervention by steering. So I would imagine that a unicycle rider with leans does deliberately steer into the direction of the lean, and that steering then provides a centrifugal force that pushes him back upright. And that's presumably why a unicycle is much harder to ride than a bicycle. You have to provide that stability by your own manual intervention rather than allowing the bike to provide it in the way we've discussed.
I have a few questions. You use this model kind of simplifying the structure of the bicycle, right? So my question is if there are other parameters or anything else that compromises the stability of the bicycle. For example, what about if I take two wheels with different radius and if the separation between the two wheels compromises or not the stability of the bicycle?
So the wheel-based distance enters into the formula for the radius of turn. Basically, if you have a greater wheelbase, I think that increases the radius of turn. So that means that you don't have to turn as far in order to get the greatest to get that radius of turn in order to get a centrifugal effect. So basically, when you change those sorts of parameters of bicycle frame design, that changes what sort of centrifugal forces you have available to you. And so basically, the bicycle frame, if you're going for stability rather than speed, should be such as to maximise the centrifugal force that pushes you back upright. Obviously, there are other factors that come into consideration. If you want speed as well, you might want to have some sacrifice of stability for speed if that's your aim.
So you guys analyze bicycles. I'm wondering if for things that are a bit more extreme, like a super bike, where the wheels are heavier, the speeds you're going on are much faster, if there would be any changes where you change the regime where one of the effects would dominate the other because of the... have you guys thought about that?
So if you make the wheels or the bicycle frame heavier, for instance, that means that even in the case, in the riderless case, for instance, the potential energies are going to be quite great for lowering the centre of mass. So what that means is that the gyroscopic effect will have more trouble compensating under those circumstances. On the other hand, if the whole frame is heavier, that means the normal torque will be greater even in the absence of a rider on top. So that means that you're going to get a difference in the sorts of regimes you need to consider, that you're more likely to have sort of similar effects uniformly whether there's a bicycle, a rider on top or not. So the stability, the reasons for the stability will change under those circumstances, but there will still be the stability because you'll just be replacing the gyroscopic effect with the normal torque effect.
I mean, if I can add, all we're basically doing is sort of shift, the regime stays the same. I mean, their range of applicability changes. So if you had a slider, for example, you'd slide it more to this side or the other. That's pretty much it. It's a reasonably effective model for most situations.
Now, the second effect works because the steering column is angled forward. So the axis of the steering column intersects the ground ahead of where the wheel hits the ground. If you built a bike where the steering column was angled backwards, would that give the opposite effect?
Good question. Yes, David Jones did in fact do that. His second unrideable bicycle was he built a bike where the trail was reversed, so that the intersection was the other way around. He did indeed find that was more or less impossible to ride because everything has the opposite effect. You end up the bicycle will steer itself out of the turn and produce a centrifugal force and push you back down. So basically, you fall over almost immediately on a bike like that. Yeah, not a good idea. Don't do it.
Any other person? The crazy bikes where you turn the wheel and then it goes the other way, those are pretty difficult to ride as well. Is that the same? Does that have the same effect?
I don't have a very clear picture in my head, but I suppose if you turn the wheel all the way around, you're going to be putting the trail, again, reversing the trail, so it's the wrong way around. And so again, when you have your... once you've done that, you then have the centrifugal forces pushing you towards the ground rather than up. So yeah, again.
I was thinking, is it difficult to ride because your natural reaction is to turn it? You have to naturally turn it the wrong way, or is there something intrinsic to that?
It's intrinsic in that if you reverse the direction of the trail, so the steering axis behind rather than in front of the point of contact, the forces will then push the other way. So when the bicycle is leaning this way, instead of steering into the curve, the bicycle will naturally steer out of the curve, and that will produce a centrifugal force pushing you further towards the ground. So that effect is independent of anything that the rider does under those circumstances. In addition, there's also probably going to be difficulties that your instincts won't produce the right effects as well if you do what you would naturally do. Anybody else?
Did you look at anything with mountain biking? Like, one thing I found is that going up really steep hills, it's hard not to do a wheelie and, like, fall over backwards.
But that has more to do with, actually, the way your center of gravity shifts. Your center of gravity goes up, 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 and you're actually going up the incline, so the component of your weight that is acting pushes you back over. So there's actually a torque because of that. It has not much to do with, actually, the stability of the bike. Along the road, it actually has more to do with the stability of the bike in the plane that you're riding in?
Yeah, the calculations we did all assumed that you were riding on a flat surface. Obviously, if you're tilted upwards, that's going to change the direction in which your weight force acts. I would have to go back and think about some more, but I would imagine that interferes with the normal torque effect quite significantly because it's going to change all the angles. And presumably, if your slope is high enough, you could possibly have something similar, and that the centrifugal force is going to start pushing the wrong sort of way. But I have to, do the calculations.
Let's thank our speakers again.
So next up, we have Bruno Swan, lovely telling us about the structure and motion of spider webs.
Hello. So today Juan and me are going to be talking about the structure and motion of spiders' webs. And so these are broadly the categories we'll be talking about: the different kinds of vibrations which move along a spider's web, the resonance effects, the attenuation, and we tried to do a little bit of analytical mechanics on our own. We don't know whether that's right, but it's just something we tried. So, yeah. Now, spiders' webs are actually architectural wonders. They're natural systems under tension and stress, and the design is highly efficient and balances the cost and profits of the geometry and mechanics of the web beautifully. The mass distribution is optimal, and it's a naturally stressed system which balances the induced stresses economically and efficiently. They are made, the actual material of the web is made of very strong polymers. And in fact, the spiders have about half a dozen different glands which produce different kinds of silks with different kinds of uses. So basically, there are three kinds of vibrations. We have transverse, longitudinal, and torsional vibrations, which propagate along the web. Transverse, as we know, is displacement perpendicular to the plane of the long axis of the fiber. Longitudinal is displacement along the direction of propagation. And torsional is basically propagation of a rotation or twist along the direction of propagation. And in transverse, yeah. So basically, transverse vibrations are the most significant and relevant vibrations, since they are the ones which actually help in the capture of prey. And but they're also most sensitive to attenuation by the mass of the body of the spider. We have longitudinal vibrations, which they're independent of the tension in the silk, unlike the transverse vibrations. But they do depend upon the length of the silk, the density, and the Young's modulus. These are also the fastest vibrations propagating along the web. And torsional waves, they're not really significant unless the spider is really jiving about in its web. It's basically, they don't help much. Then, as with any propagation of waves in a medium, we do have the resonance effect. When the wavelength of the propagation is about the order of the distance between two junctions, it tends to vibrate with a very large amplitude at certain frequencies, and these frequencies are called the resonant frequencies. And basically, this depends upon the length of the fiber and the velocity of the waves propagating along it. We have at the body of a spider sitting on the web can also show resonant effects if stimulated at certain frequencies. This is in fact what helps it capture the prey, because we read this paper and we found out that detecting the vibrations, the spider can actually find out whether a prey has landed on its web, whether it's just a leaf, whether it's a predator. So it's actually pretty cool how it detects a prey just by the frequency of the vibration on its web. Then, we discussed the effects of the frequencies, like supposing the spiral strands of a spider web, where it reduces the tension and correspondingly reduces the frequency of the resonant modes. If we have vibrations perpendicular to the plane, they stiffen the fiber, increase the tension, and correspondingly increase the frequency. Then, of course, if the motion is parallel to the plane, it won't have any effect on the frequency whatsoever. Finally, attenuation. Transmission of vibration is affected by attenuation, and the energy dissipated goes out into the surrounding air. Silk junctions are these areas where spiral threads meet the radial part of the web, and so basically these increase the amount of attenuation a lot and decrease the amplitude of the wave traveling across. So this is basically the qualitative aspects of a spider web and the vibration of waves across it. What we try to do now is construct a Lagrangian for a very general two-dimensional lattice, get the equations of motion, and whatever I talked about right now, attenuation, resonance, blah, 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 we try to mathematically get that from our equations of motion, and Juan will talk more about that.
First, I will start by thanking the organizers to give me the opportunity to stand here and to say something about my opinions of the vibrations. It's a little bit serious. So first, I can easily write down a very generalized Lagrangian for the vibration of the web. Actually, we can just say it as too generalized, because the Lagrangian doesn't depend on the dimension of the system we have. If we have a very specific lattice model, it should be like that to the second order. The phi is the displacement of the latice size, and the M matrix is the coefficient of the effective mass, and the coefficient is the K matrix is the coefficients of the potential. So by Euler Lagrangian equation, we can easily write down the equation of movement. So I call it. I forgot to say that the summation over the repeated indices are performed. I call this equation quasi-quantum equation. It's my terminology. I just say it a QQ equation for short. But how to solve it very analytically without a solution, we can't say anything about it. But normally, just to forget about analytical solution because we can't obtain it. But how about numerical solutions? We can. I have to say that we can do it in a very large lattice model because the space we are in grows exponentially with the lattice size. So actually, we cannot obtain very exact solutions to this equation of motion. But we can still get very intuitive pictures from this equation of motion. So from this QQ equation, we can get a very formal solutions by split the variables. This is a little bit serious. Anyway, EI are the eigenvalues of this matrix. But normally we have three cases of the EI's signs. For positive EIs, this mode of the movement will decay very quickly because of the exponential. And for the minus signs of minus signs, we get the resonance because the exponential becomes actually sines and cosines, and it will oscillating forever. For the third case, we have the zero EIs, but this solution is not the right solution we have. Normally, we have the critical damping. It does not decay exponentially, but it will decay for a while. Personally, I don't think the spiders will like the resonance because I can't think that spiders sitting on the web and forever. We cannot just stop here. We have some other things to explore in the next slides. First thing is about the symmetry. I worked on condensed matter physics, so I can't help myself thinking about something happening in condensed matter physics. There is a Xiaogang-Wen here in parameter promotes something about symmetry-protected topological phase. I give you three examples, like topological insulators are protected by time reversal symmetry, Haldane phase are protected by rotational symmetry, and Maruyama fermions in solids are protected by charge Hall symmetry. They are classified by group cohomology theory, a little bit fancy, but what I want to say here is we have the very similar why I call this equation of movement quasi quantum equation because they are very similar mathematically to quantum mechanics. So I just wonder if we have symmetry in our spider web, is there any motion that is protected by our symmetry? So spider webs generally have rotational symmetry and the reflection symmetry. For the second point, in condensed matter physics, you have to consider about the defects. Generally, this paper talks about some defects. This time talks is the force distribution of undamaged webs for some very specific conditions. You can see that the red. Radio strings of the spider suffers from much more forces from the spiral strings. But what if we have the damaged What if we have the defects? The next slide talks about something about defects. You know, you can see that some of the strings are disappear, but qualitatively, the picture is still the same. The radial strings suffer more force than the spiral strings. The next slide contains our solutions. It's a little bit. Can I just read them? The transverse waves communicate to the spider the location of its prey, and the frequency of the vibration indicates the nature of object caught in the web. Low frequency vibration suggests non-living objects, and blah 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 blah. And this is very important because there are no resonance peaks in frequency range of most flying insects, and something like that. Thank you.
I have a little question. You have this Lagrangian for your equations of motion.
Yeah.
And the solution looks really impossible to find it analytically, right? But what about if you consider the spider web instead of a lattice, a membrane? Well, consider your spider web as a membrane, a two-dimensional membrane.
You cannot really do that because...
No. It's just, I know, but it's just that maybe the solutions to how does vibrations propagate on a two-dimensional membrane might give some insight on how the solutions for the actual lattice would be.
But what I mean that we can't get exact solutions from this equation of movement is the boundary conditions. Mm-hmm. If we have very difficult boundary conditions, we cannot get very beautiful solutions. So it does not matter if it is lattice or it is membrane. It's the boundary conditions that matters.
And we didn't know the exact kind of boundary conditions to impose, so we took a very general two-dimensional lattice.
So if you think this Lagrangian live in the one-dimensional spring lattice, two lattice sides are linked by a spring, this is very easy to solve. But if you change the form and if you change the boundary conditions, it will be very difficult.
Right, but when, for example, an insect lands in the spider web, the vibration doesn't propagate through all of the web, or does it? Because you can impose the simple boundary condition that the vibrations are zero at the boundary of your web.
I don't know that.
Right?
Because it's hard to do the numerics.
Right. But it's just like some qualitative approach or whatsoever.
Are you saying have a system which is very similar to a circular drum sheet?
Or perhaps
but that's almost non-realistic because then the thing with the spider web is that each site has the ability to work separately and you've actually got each square.
Right, but it's
or
just like, for example, this might work for this little spider where the spider web is almost a membrane, where you cannot see the holes within the spider web.
You mean like a Bessel function you have?
Kind of.
Even for membrane, if you cannot solve it very analytically, you have to solve it numerically. Membrane is more hard to it's harder to solve it numerically. I don't think it's a very good way to describe it in a membrane.
He said that the spider could locate its prey on the web just through the vibrations. Could you maybe explain that a little bit more? Oh.
Sorry?
You said that the spider can locate its prey on the web just through the vibrations.
Through the range of vibrations.
Can
through the range of the frequency of the vibrations.
So through the spectrum of the...
Supposing it recognizes an insect which is a prey, when it lands on the web, it generates vibrations which lie in a particular frequency range which the spider recognizes. It also recognizes something, I think in the last... Yeah, so
a very low frequency, say, which is just a few hertz, a leaf or a twig or something, the spider recognizes that that's probably just an inanimate object, not worthy of interest. And it also recognizes frequencies of predators and obviously not approach them.
But how does it know where on the web?
Because I talk about resonance. There are certain frequencies where the body of the spider itself resonates along with the web. I mean, it's certain stimulated frequencies. So it recognizes those and correspondingly attacks its prey.
Just related to that, the same thing. So is there some sort of directional bias in terms of the propagation of the waves based on which the spider can locate the prey?
You mean like a
because like if the whole web has those vibrations, the spider will be able to tell that my food's somewhere, but where it is not quite obvious.
That
how does it locate where the vibrations are sort of coming from? Or what's the source?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a mechanism by which it does that, but
I don't think we got that. Related to that, do you know what the actual structure of the junctions between filaments is? Is it, I mean, we think usually of spiders weaving, but do they actually wrap a fiber around, or is it just kind of stuck on top?
The structure of the web?
Yeah.
We did have that on our first slide. It's actually, there is no definite structure. It varies. In fact, a spiral can even vary the number of spiral and radial threads in its web without affecting the strength. It adapts to very versatile environments that way. If it wants to trap small insects, it increases the density of the spiral webs without affecting the strength or tensile strength or anything. But like this is typically a spiral web you would find somewhere. So you have these silk junctions, which are where the spiral threads conjoin with the radial threads. And I mean, is that what you were asking?
Well, I'm asking more about at the actual juncture.
Yeah.
Is it just a point contact where the two threads, because they're presumably sticky, just stick together? Or is it that one is wrapped around the other so that there's a little bit more security? Which would presumably change how the direction of propagation spreads.
I think it is wrapped around, which is why it also contributes to the attenuation of the waves.
Okay.
Not just some sticking video.
I just wanted to confirm your conclusion, because I tried once throwing some little leaves on the web, and I thought I fooled the spider as I saw it rushing towards the leaf. I thought it was going to like wrap around and start sucking its leaves. But it turns out that I just threw the leaf away from the web immediately and went back to its center position.
Okay.
It was very efficient.
Okay. We refer to a paper by Burskirk and this other guy, Frederick and Burskirk. So according to them, this is the conclusion. I don't know.
Yes. Can you explain a little bit more about why you call your that equation quasi-quantum equation? And I mean, is this in what way is it similar to the quantum thing? And also, what makes you think there might be some symmetry protected topological thing there?
Not sure. I just want to be fancy. I don't know for sure. There are at least two things between these things and the real symmetry protected right border. The first is that the symmetry here is easy to be broken. Like the rotational symmetry, you consider a real spider web. It's actually not very rotational environment. And also the reflection symmetry is easy to break. Actually quantum mechanics has U1 gauge symmetry, but here we have no U1 gauge symmetry. That's the key point.
So a couple of slides before the conclusion, you had the plots of force in different webs,
yeah.
And there was some parameter, big K over little K. What were those?
They describe the screen. That's just the way it describe the screen. I don't remember very exactly.
No. There was a that's two.
Yeah.
The one before.
Just there's some parameter. I don't remember very exactly. They are just just green coefficient or something.
But it says they're both dimensions, right?
Yeah. So where does the dissipation come from?
Dispersion.
Right when
the dimension. The dissipation of the waves propagating along the way. One is the silk junctions, which I talked about. And any wave would be damped as it propagates across. So the air friction, I suppose, even the mass of the spider, that contributes to dissipation.
Oh, so this just means that all these matrices, they are complex in general.
Yes.
Thank the speakers again.